great results from Bystander CPR.
What happens if you really lower cholesterol substantially?
A new treatment for ulcerative colitis.
And handgun purchases after mass shootings.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on May 5th, 2017. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I think we should start first with the Annals of Internal Medicine study, the one that you cited as handgun purchases after events. This was in California. What do we know based on this study?
Elizabeth, each year there are more than 32,000 individuals who die of gunshot wounds. And although mass shootings receive a lot of public attention, they result or account for less than 1% of these deaths. But obviously to the public, these are very visible forms. What this study addressed is how mass shootings affect handgun purchases over the subsequent weeks. These authors developed data from California over the course of 9 years, looked at handgun purchases in California, and then also examined two specific events, the mass shootings that happened in Newton, Connecticut in 2012 and San Bernardino, California in 2015, to see if that influenced handgun purchases. And here's what they discovered. Over that 9-year period, there were about 3 million handgun purchases in California. If you track it over the course of years, it seemed to triple the weekly number of handguns purchased in 2007 versus 2016. But there were two particularly high spikes related to these mass shootings. In San Bernardino, following the mass shooting, handgun purchase increased about 85% over a short period of time.
I'm not exactly sure what we can do about this from a public health perspective. Clearly, the public has a right to know about these kinds of things. I'm not sure that we could offer caveats like, hey, don't let this go out there and cause you to purchase a handgun if you wouldn't ordinarily. So how does this really help us?
I think a couple of follow-up things we need to look at. One is we know that there's an increased risk of homicides and suicides related to the number of handguns available. We need to be aware of that. Second thing, you're absolutely right, is we need to figure out what we need to do to educate individuals, and we need to get more data because the perception is that these are for protection. These are first-time owners doing this, and actually nobody's really looked at that.
And so I guess we can conclude with that for this time, that we know that there are all kinds of constraints on gun research here in this country and that those really need to be lifted so that we can get the numbers and figure out really where we are.
That's a major message.
Okay, let's move then to the New England Journal of Medicine, where we're going to spend the rest of our time. Something that we had foreshadowed from a study in Japan a couple of years ago relative to bystander-administered CPR and outcomes relative to heart attacks. This is more about that and also using defibrillators.
Much of the data we've reported on have been done with short-term outcomes. What happens long-term, nobody's really ever looked at that. So these investigators examined the data in Denmark. This is nationwide data, so it's pretty good. There are over 5 million individuals that live in Denmark, and all of them enrolled in national health information databases. So over the course of about an 11-year period, there were 42,000 patients who had an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. There were almost 3,000 who received CPR and survived for 30 days. And what they discovered was that the individuals that had bystander CPR were much more likely to survive, less likely to have anoxic brain injury, and more likely to be alive 1 year later. About a twofold to threefold increase in being alive 1 year later. And as you mentioned, not only bystander CPR, but the best outcome was when bystanders use the defibrillator. What I want most of our listeners to understand is, first of all, they need to know how to do CPR, and it's incredibly easy. Now it's just compression-only CPR. The second is defibrillators are also incredibly easy to use. These public access defibrillators walk you through how to use them. We shouldn't be afraid of doing it.
And I think this is really powerful confirmatory data showing that, gosh, you really can improve the outcomes and improve the outcomes in someone who's going to be just fine when they walk out of the hospital.
Showing not only short-term benefit, but long-term benefit as well. We need to embrace this.
Excellent. Let us turn now to a study on an agent, PCSK9. They're going to have to name it something because, you know, going through all of these consonants, I think, is a little challenging. And LDL cholesterol.
The evidence is irrefutable that for people that have high cholesterol, they're at risk for cardiovascular events, heart attacks, strokes, and lowering that cholesterol, either with diet or lifestyle, or for people that are unsuccessful in getting it lower, using a statin reduces either first time or subsequent cardiac events substantially. There are new agents to lower cholesterol, and you mentioned one of those, the PCSK9. This involves the receptor. And the less PCSK9 you have, the more the receptor is available to draw LDL cholesterol out of the bloodstream. So we have this new set of agents that's been shown to reduce cholesterol. It's nice if they lower cholesterol, but what I want to know is, do they reduce the risk of having a stroke or a heart attack or needing coronary revascularization? And what about people that are already on statins? So this was a very large study where there are over 27,000 patients that had known atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. They had an LDL cholesterol that was just mildly elevated, some of them actually in the normal range, if they were already receiving statins, and they received this antibody injection every 2 weeks and were followed an average of 2 years. In people with nearly normal cholesterol already on a statin, the addition of this agent lowered their cholesterol by about 60%, and it lowered the risk of having the composite endpoint of cardiovascular death, heart attack or stroke or hospitalization for heart disease by about 15 to 20%.
Of course, one of its disadvantages is the injectable nature of it. While that's not terribly onerous, it's also not the easiest thing for people to comply with.
It's not, but because it's an antibody, we can't take it orally because it's degraded by the enzymes and acids in our stomach. However, I think this shows a couple things. We want to target the cholesterol between 70 and 100, LDL cholesterol for people that have heart disease. This dropped it down to 25 or 30, and it proves the point that the lower we get it, there's still substantially improved outcome with regard to cardiovascular status, and there really were no significant side effects. So the message is clear. The lower you can get your LDL cholesterol, the better off you are.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and suggest that it would be really great if we could develop other agents that could be oral agents that do this. And I'm wondering if it is the secondary mechanism, in addition to statins, that help to produce this benefit.
It's possible. You know, statins reduce inflammation. As far as we know, this antibody only targets PCSK9. So I actually think this is probably related to the reduction of LDL cholesterol, although we may discover something in the future. But right now, that appears to be the major benefit.
Okay, so we'll be watching that as it gets to more broad application. Finally, let's turn to a new agent for ulcerative colitis.
Ulcerative colitis is characterized by individuals that have an increased frequency of bowel movements. Oftentimes they have bloody diarrhea, which affects the quality of life and also has substantial health implications. So this is an inflammatory disease of the colon. And although we have some agents like steroids and things that affect some of the known inflammatory mediators like tumor necrosis factor, many individuals don't respond to these. So we're always looking for new types of agents. There's a family called the Janus kinase family, or JAK, J-A-K family, that are also involved in the inflammatory process and appear to play a role in ulcerative colitis. If we inhibit this particular pathway, can we induce remission? If we continue that, can we maintain that? So these were three different phase 3 trials, all conducted with the same agent, tofacitinib. It's an oral small molecule JAK inhibitor to individuals that had ulcerative colitis. Compared to standard therapy, they were twice as effective at inducing remission. And then importantly, over the long term, they were able to maintain that as well. They're about 3 to 4-fold more successful at retaining remission than standard therapy. It's a new pathway, it's a new oral agent, and it may be an alternative to individuals that aren't responding to standard therapy.
Right, because this disease can be incredibly impactful on somebody's quality of life. So I found it attractive for that reason. What about the side effect profile?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because, as you might imagine, if you're affecting the inflammatory process or the immune process, there can be significant side effects. And in this particular one, there was an increased risk of severe infections and an increased risk of herpes zoster as well. So the upside is it can treat ulcerative colitis. The downside is it increases the risk of having an infection because you're affecting the immune system.
If you were a betting guy, what would you say as far as this transition to a commercially available agent for this one?
I think clearly this agent or one similar to it that affect this pathway will become a part of the standard therapy. In particular, it will be an option for individuals that aren't responding to other types of therapy, conventional therapy we have right now. Again, with the caveat is when you have patients on it, you have to realize that it increases the risk of infection and be vigilant about informing the patient about that.
Okay. On that note, I'm going to talk about the PCSK9 agent.
That's easy for you to say.
Yeah, exactly. One of these days I'll learn how to say that. Just about the time I do, it's going to have a brand name or something else that'll trip off the tongue a little more easily. On the blog this week, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.